I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everyone, this is David Kern. Thanks so much for checking out this podcast. I won't keep you too long, but I did want to say a quick word from our friends over at Duke University's Arete Initiative. This summer, from July 9th through the 14th, they're going to be hosting the High School Summer Seminar on Ethics, Philosophy, and Religion on Duke's campus in Durham, North Carolina. This seminar is going to prepare high school students with a roadmap for approaching those same subjects in college. Using texts from literature, philosophy, and theology, the seminar will examine such topics as the meaning of virtue, the substance of human nature, the question of human flourishing, the metaphysics of reality, and the nature of truth. Students will also discuss the ideas of natural law, the relationship between philosophy and theology, and the relationship between science and religion. The seminar will be co-taught by several Duke University instructors and professors. It's open to current high school students entering their junior or senior years. There's no fee associated with applying or attending. Let me repeat that. There is no fee at all for applying or attending. And those admitted will be housed in the Duke dormitories and provided with meal cards. So again, that's no fee of any kind associated with applying or attending, and it includes lodging and meal cards. Pretty good deal, I think. Students interested in applying should email John Rose at john.rose@duke.edu. That's john.rose@duke.edu. Applications will be considered on a rolling basis until April 26th, 2018. And again, that's john.rose@duke.edu. And with that, enjoy your show. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Forma, a podcast featuring conversations with authors, teachers, creators, and leaders who are carefully contemplating the nature and practice of classical education. I am David Kern, and today on the show, I am excited to bring you an interview that I did with someone who I have been wanting to talk to for a long time. Mr. Jonathan Rogers has been on the Circe Podcast Network before on Brian Phillips' show, The Commons. In this episode, though, of Forma, he and I talked about his fiction, and in particular, his fiction series, The Wilder King Trilogy, which begins with The Bark of the Bog Owl, continues with The Secret of the Swamp King, and concludes with The Way of the Wilder King. If you listened to my recent interview with Sarah McKenzie, you heard her offer up some fantastic praise for Jonathan Rogers' series. And I just wanted to kind of follow up on her comments by saying that I agree with those. Jonathan Rogers' books for young adults and for children, or what he calls middle grade books, are fantastic. I have been reading The Bark of the Bog Owl with my kids, just finished that one. And as I kind of explain in the interview with Jonathan coming up, they wanted to jump right into book two, The Secret of the Swamp King, and we did that. They are really good. I highly recommend them. He calls them fantasy stories or fantasy adventure stories told in an American accent. The description on his website mentions that they are peopled by boasters, brawlers, bumpkins, con men, cowboys, and swampers, and they draw deeply from the American vernacular storytelling traditions. They harness the humor of that tradition in the service of divine comedy, a worldview in which the sorrows and hurts of this world, as true as they might be, aren't nearly so true as a vital joy and love that will one day sweep everything before them like a flood. We talk in this interview a little bit about some of the influences on his books, including Mark Twain. We talk about his process and where these stories came from, the genesis of these books, so to speak, and much, much more, including some stories that Jonathan tells about his native Georgia and the people that he knew there. I love this interview. I love talking to Jonathan Rogers. He loves books. He loves writing. And he loves his stories, and you can tell that. It comes across in the interview. If you want to learn more about Jonathan Rogers, you can head over to jonathan-rogers.com, jonathan-rogers, rogers.com. Also, his books are all available on Audible. So if you're looking for an audio version of these books, or you know, you're on, you're got a trip coming up, or you just need something to occupy your kids sometimes, and you know you can't read to them, or you know maybe they're not readers yet. The Audible version is an excellent option. You can use your credits there, so if you just go over to Audible and search for one of those book titles, then you'll find them easily, and you can snatch those up. They're all available on the Rabbit Room as well, and we talk a little bit about that on the show. So without further ado, I will get it over to my interview with Jonathan Rogers here on Forma. Thanks for listening and enjoy the interview.
The main thing that I wanted to talk to you about was the Wilder King trilogy of books. Did you consider them, what did you consider them, young adult books, children's books? How do you?
I mean, I call them middle grade.
Okay. Books. Yeah. So I'm reading those right now with my kids, and we're well into the second one now. Mm-hmm. It was the kind of thing where we read the first one, they really liked it, and then next thing I knew, they wanted to read the next one. I think we were going to take a break. We were going to read, I don't remember what it was, something else. And they were like, nope, we're going, next one, please.
That's great. They're obviously people of taste and decency.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what the lesson that I'm learning from this is, that my kids have taste and decency. Yeah. So I guess I was curious about the genesis of these books, the origin story, not necessarily where you got the inspiration, but where you kind of, what was your process in writing them? So, well, I guess let's start with where the idea came from. Was this something that you had been working on for a long time, and it kind of was fermenting and aging, so to speak, and kind of turning into something, or was it something that came to you all of a sudden?
I can sort of identify the week it came to me. I had, gone down to Florida to visit some friends. I had quit my job, or was sort of working out my 2 month notice. And with my last vacation days, I went down to Florida to see some friends, and was listening to a series of sermons by Eugene Peterson about David. Yeah. And was sort of struck by the narrative possibilities in the David story. Not like that's news that there's narrative possibilities in the David story, but I just was marinating in those. Especially interested in this idea of what would it be like to know that you're going to be the king someday, but you're not the king yet, and you still have to be loyal to the current king, and those issues along those lines. And I really loved the stories about him in the wilderness with his mighty men. And so I was sort of marinating in those stories, and at the same time going out every day and canoeing in the swamps.
Oh yeah,
in Florida, and I always loved. You know, that I grew up in the southern half of Georgia, well, really the middle of Georgia, but they were kind of right where the flat sandy part starts. And so I was always fascinated by swamps and alligators and all that kind of stuff. And so between those, sort of thinking about the David story and living among the alligators and the snakes in Florida, this story sort of started to take shape. I thought it'd be really fun to think about some of those narrative possibilities in a more American setting, specifically something that looks like the American South. And so then I went to a bagel shop in Orlando, Florida, and started writing, started outlining what became the Wilder King trilogy.
So why didn't you just set it in America then? What was the, you know, why a fictional world when you, that looks like American South and not just the actual American South?
Well, you know, I wanted to have some flexibility to do. I guess early on I was thinking more medievally, sort of a medieval type story.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, there wasn't any medieval times in the American South.
Right.
I guess there was, but there weren't. I guess the American South was here during the medieval period too, and so I just sort of gave me some flexibility. And as you get deeper into the story, you may notice that the more kings and castle kind of stuff fades into the background a little bit. And then by the time I get to the Charlatan's Boy, the fourth book, which is set in the same world, it's more of a kind of a cowboy setting. You know, it's still Cornwall, but those, you know, there's not much medievally stuff left in that story.
Were you writing these for your own kids, or just the idea came to you, so you thought, I'm just going to write these and see what happens, or
was I was writing them. I wrote one chapter and showed it to an agent and said, "You think you could sell this if I finish this story?" And he said he thought he could, and so I went ahead and wrote it, which in retrospect wasn't nearly enough, encouragement to justify sitting down and writing a whole book, but it worked out.
Yeah.
And so I was writing for my kids insofar as I was reading, I would read a chapter. As I finished a chapter, I'd read it to them. But it wasn't one of those stories where, you hear about people saying, "Well, I was just telling my kids a story and then I decided to write it down." It wasn't that kind of thing, really. Right.
Were they giving you feedback as they were going? Were they like, "Man, maybe Aiden should do this," or,
a little bit. Mostly I would just kind of pay attention to when they look bored or when they laugh or whatever.
Yeah. So, did you talk about David, the story of David in the Bible being an inspiration for you? Yeah. And, there's obviously some very clear parallels between the David story in the Bible, the killing of the giant and so forth. Was there a point for you as you were working on it where you were thinking, okay, this part is going to be really consistent with the biblical story, such as the giant sort of scenario. And that you've got like Darrow being Saul and Aiden being David and so forth. Were there points when you were saying, okay, this has to be very true to that story, have a real parallel structure? And then other times you were saying, "Oh, I'm going to veer off here so it's not like too parallel," or did it just sort of happen and evolve? And was there purposefulness in that, or was it your appreciation for the biblical story just sort of flowing out of you into the book that you were writing?
Well, I was just kind of feeling my way through it, trying to figure out how to do it. I'd never written a book before, never really even written a short story before I sat down to write The Bark of the Bog Owl. And so I was kind of just figuring out how to do it. Initially I thought that I'm just going to retell the David story, pretty close. But it's going to be in a swampy place.
Okay.
And then as the story kind of found itself as I went through, I think, in the second and third book in the trilogy, it hews less and less closely to the Bible story.
Okay.
But I found the first pages I ever wrote in the process. Huh. And I literally just had the names David and Goliath because I hadn't come up with character names yet. Yeah. That's how close I was sticking to the story at first. As I said, as that story kind of found its legs, it was really the later parts of the story are related to the Bible story in a very broad sense. So it's really it's the three kinds of adventure story, right? I shouldn't say the three because I'm sure there are more than three, but three major adventure story motifs. There's the giant killing in the first book. In the second book, that's the quest story. The hero gets sent out on an impossible quest.
Yeah.
And then in the third story, it's the Robin Hood story, living as an outlaw, but doing the trying to do the right thing. Hmm. All of which are contained in the David story, of course. It didn't feel as important. It quickly felt less important to me to do anything even remotely allegorical as I got into it. But on the other hand, that first scene that I wrote, which was the David, the giant killing scene, I feel like this is a major spoiler alert, but anyway, anchored into the story in such a way that there was no, there was no going back on that particular scene.
Oh yeah.
But as I said, it got a little less close.
Well, for people who are worried about spoilers, you may know, your parents may know what's going on, but your kids can still be surprised by the.
That's right.
So for you, it wasn't so much about the narrative arc because you felt like you were touching on sort of universal narrative arcs that are so many different adventure stories are.
And I think if I remember correctly, it's been a long time since I've heard those sermons from Eugene Peterson that I was telling you about a minute ago. They became a book called Leap Over a Wall, which is quite a good book. And if I remember correctly, he kind of points out that the various, you know, standard adventure stories are in the David story. I think that's probably where I got that from.
Okay. So then was it for you, was it more about, as you said, kind of what's going on in the head of a character who's
a person? Yeah, I mean, what's it like to, young David in the Bible story has to figure out what's it like to find out that the people who told me that God is faithful don't believe it themselves. What's it like for, you know, for, the person I'm supposed to be loyal to, the king I'm supposed to be loyal to be disloyal to me. You know, he's going through some really difficult things that I think kids have to go through. Mm-hmm. Kids whose parents have taken them to Sunday school, and then sometimes I see their parents aren't living like they believe what they've told them is true. Mm-hmm. I've always been fascinated with what it would have been like for David to be in that situation.
Yeah. Did you find that you were trying to, did you find it difficult to get in the head of that character, of your character? Or did you feel like the character of Aiden, who's your protagonist, that's kind of your, I don't know, we'll call him a doppelganger for David. Did you get into his head pretty easily, or was there?
Yeah, that didn't seem, that wasn't terribly hard.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's the swamp people, the Fiji folks, they were relatively easy to get in their heads too, because I went to school with those people, you know.
So, what was your process like? Because did you know that you were going to write 3-4 books? Was that this was going to be, you know, maybe a trilogy at first?
Yeah, I knew early on it was going to take 3 shortish books to tell the story. I never really wanted to write, you know, 1 500-page book for young readers. You know, I wanted to write 3, you know, 250-page books or whatever. I knew very early on, I knew how the story was going to break into 3.
Okay. Yeah. So you wrote 4.
Yeah.
And so did you sketch out an outline for 4 books at the beginning, or did you outline 1 and then say, okay, I'll figure it out after that?
Yeah. The Wilder King is 1 story. That's a 1 story in 3 books. And then The Charlton's Boy is a whole other story set in the same world.
Expanded universe type thing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
So do you have plans for another one?
That's the hope, to write a sequel to The Charlton's Boy. That's the plan. Let's don't call it a hope. Let's call it a plan.
Yeah.
The last page of The Charlton's Boy says, coming in 2011, you know, the sequel. And that we had a bit of a miscommunication there. I didn't realize that, actually, I never did agree to deliver a book. That was 2010. And it said in 2011, the story continues. And as I said, that was news to me. When I flipped to the back page, I thought, huh.
Guess I better get to work.
Yeah, right.
So when did you write the first one? Back in like 05, 04, something like that? Am I
right? The Bog Owl came out in 04. So I wrote it in 02.
Okay.
Yeah. Wrote it in 02 and then finished it in at the end of 02. And then it came out in 04.
So what was the process like trying to sell that? Just trying to find someone who kind of understood your vision for it. And was that pretty easy, or was it a job?
Well, as it turns out, that was pretty miraculous. I living in Nashville, there are plenty of literary agents around here.
Yeah.
And so just a friend of a friend was a literary agent. What I didn't know at the time was that I was his first client. And so, but he took it and did a great job of finding a publisher for it. So it was originally published in with Broadman and Holman, and then 04, 05, and 06 were when those 3 books came out, and then they ended up giving me the rights back, and it came out again through Rabbit Room Press,
right?
Yep. In 14, I think it was.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense now, because I felt like I had seen other covers. Or were the covers different?
They were hard covers before.
Okay. So
yeah, they gave me the rights to the cover art too, which was very generous.
Oh wow. Okay. Yeah. So Rabbit Room has them now. It seems like, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it seems like there has been something of a recent renaissance in terms of interest, or maybe an increase in interest in these books. Considering they came out you know, 12, 13 years ago, that's yeah. a pretty good shelf life. So, you know, yeah, right. so to speak.
No, they've definitely come back to life.
Why is that? What do you think that is?
Well, a big part of it is that Sarah McKenzie got a hold of them.
Sarah wields great power.
She does. Yes. I hope she uses it for good and not for ill.
I'm pretty sure she is.
was exposed to them through the Rabbit Room. You know, the Rabbit Room has started setting up a booth at a few homeschool conferences. And so she encountered all the Rabbit Room catalog. And she's gotten excited about what we're doing at the Rabbit Room. And so that's how they came back to life.
The Rabbit Room, y'all have a lot of good titles. I mean, I guess a little bit of an aside from your specific titles, but yeah. Is that a big part of what the Rabbit Room's after, is creating these middle grade young adult novels that can kind of continue in the tradition of the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe type books?
I wouldn't call that a stated goal. Actually, I know it's not a stated goal of the Rabbit Room, and Rabbit Room's just interested in the intersection of faith and art and friendship. And as it turns out, you know, Andrew Peterson, he wrote the Wingfeather books.
Yeah.
I wrote the Wilder King books. And so there's seven books for middle grade readers right there. Doug McKelvey wrote a great book called The Angel Knew Papa and the Dog.
I read that to my kids last year.
I love that book. Yeah. And then Jennifer Trafton, with Henry and the Chalk Dragon and The Rise and Fall of Mount Majestic.
Yep.
Not all those are Rabbit Room Press, but they are by Rabbit Room people.
Yeah. Okay.
And
I just read Rise and Fall actually as well.
Isn't that a fun book?
Yeah, my kids really liked that one. Yeah.
I bet they did. Yeah.
We've already established
they're tasteful. They're
That's right. So, okay, since we're talking about books that people who have taste like. Let's talk about your taste a little bit. What are some of the books that inspired you to be a writer, that inspire you to write now, that inspired you as you were writing The Bark of the Bog Owl and that whole series? Can you point to any specifics that said, oh man, that's the kind of book I want to write, or man, I read this book and now I want to go read, I got to go do some writing now?
Yeah, it's funny. I wasn't even fully conscious of my influences at the time, except when somebody, you know, some reviewer commented how much my books owe to Mark Twain. My first thought was, well, no, I wasn't even thinking about Mark Twain. But then then I realized, of course, I wasn't thinking about Mark Twain because Mark Twain is always there, right?
Yeah.
I don't think about oxygen either. Mark Twain, just that. And another thing, that another big influence on me were the books that influenced Mark Twain, the sort of Southwestern humor that people don't read much anymore. And sometimes for good reason, they don't read it anymore. It's pretty horrible stuff in many cases. I don't know how much of that Southwestern humor you've been exposed to, but it's often violent and often racist, and there's all kinds of awful stuff going on in those stories. But the verbal energy that is specifically American it's been so long since I've read or thought about those books that now I can't even think. They all had three names.
Well, I love this concept of like a uniquely American verbal energy.
Yeah.
Because, you see it in Twain, obviously, and in some ways you see it sort of starting to blossom in that late 18th century, early 19th century literature, like well before Twain, even some of the stuff that's from New England. And in certain ways you see it sort of coming into its own in like Melville or James Fenimore Cooper. Yeah. It's not as fun yet there.
Yeah.
But it seems like as we moved into the wilderness more and more and kind of took pride in our,
right. Yeah, I love that turn that American literature makes where a few people said, you know, we're going to stop looking to England for how to do this, and we're going to figure this out in America. Yeah. And so that literature went from American literature, I'm speaking as if I'm not an expert on this, but it seems to me that somewhere along the line, a certain strain of American literature or American writers said, let's see what sort of grows up from the ground instead of us looking into books to see how to write. Yeah. And I mean, think about it, even, there's nothing, Homer wasn't a literary person, right? I mean, he wasn't, think about C.S. Lewis says about primary and secondary epic in Preface to Paradise Lost. Homer didn't, you don't imagine Homer had manuscripts in front of him to think about how to do what he was doing.
Right, right.
And there are certain, there are certain writers who were not, just don't feel so bookish, even though they're writing books. Mm-hmm. And so I love that strain of American literature that's not bookish.
Yeah, it's the kind of writing that has a good, comes from having a good ear.
Yeah, yeah.
It recognizes the, like a native language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're asking what books I found helpful or inspiring or whatever. Lonesome Dove, Larry McMurtry.
Yeah, I do love that book.
Man, what a great book. And I had not read Charles Portis at the time. But I have now, and man, that guy is just right up my alley.
Yeah, yeah. True Grit, which we're doing on Close Reads right now. I think you knew that we were doing that, I think.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I know about True Grit. I mean, I know y'all are doing it, and as soon as I heard y'all were doing it, I pulled it out and listened to that Donna Tartt version. My goodness, that's so good. Yeah. That audio version. Fantastic. Yeah.
I think you mentioned even in a separate conversation to me that that she has an essay at the end of that audiobook that's about True Grit, which is really good as well, right?
Yeah, it's great. Right. And the other amazing thing about that essay at the end is that you realize that Donna Tartt is just talking like Donna Tartt in that book. she's not putting on some sort of special Matty Ross voice. That's just the way she talks.
Well, one of the things I love about a book like True Grit, you get it in Flannery O'Connor, who I know you know a lot about Flannery O'Connor. Yeah. You find that even if you don't speak exactly like, I don't know, Donna Tartt or like Flannery O'Connor would have, if you didn't speak with that Georgian accent, you find that when you're reading it, you can't help but speak in that at least in some little bit, because the language is structured in a way that is true to the place that it's coming from.
That's
It's not native language. So even if you speak, if you have the harshest of Boston accents, or you're from, London somewhere, you're still going to find probably that in your own way, you are shaping words and, just because you're going with the way the sentences are created, you're speaking with sort of energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you beat me too, Flannery O'Connor. She, of course, was exceedingly important to me.
Yeah.
In large part because I spent so much of my the early part of my intellectual life trying to leave Middle Georgia, trying to learn. I've got a PhD in 17th century literature, and so I was always trying to learn I was this sort of raving Anglophile, and I was trying to learn how to speak John Milton's language. Huh. And that's, but John Milton doesn't make you want to write. He doesn't make you want to spend and write an epic poem. I mean, there's maybe some people he does, but not me. Yeah. I mean, as much as I love Milton, but I couldn't have been I could have been an academic all day long, with that kind of mindset, but I couldn't be a book writer, an author, without Flannery O'Connor sort of bringing me back to Middle Georgia. It's a happy, a happy coincidence or a happy providence that she's actually from the same part of the world that I'm from. And some of her speech ways are not just American and not just Southern, but specifically Middle Georgia. There are turns of phrase in her work, especially in her letters, that I would have never expected to see in writing, but that I'd heard all my life, Huh. And it sort of gave me a courage or a, I don't know what the word is, gave me a permission, I guess, to write in my own native tongue.
Huh. So then do you find that as you're writing, these what you call, middle grade books that you're trying to honor that native tongue, that you're trying to employ that native tongue in a book like this, even though it doesn't necessarily take place there? Or is it maybe just certain characters you want to honor that through certain characters or something like that?
I don't even know if honoring is the right word. It's just that it's just my voice. I mean, you know, I've had the, somewhere along the line, I realized that the closer I can make my voice be the same, whether I am talking to, standing in front of a class and talking, or giving a speech, or writing an essay, or writing a story, to the extent that I can, that can all be the same voice. And obviously it can be exactly the same voice all the time, but to the extent that it can, there's a little extra verbal energy that I can, what's the word? I mean, long and short of it is I have energy left to do more interesting things if I'm not having to think about voice. And so it's not even a matter of honoring any particular voice. It's a matter of settling into my own voice and letting it go.
Did you find that, I mean, did it take you a long time to realize, I don't know how to put this, to discover that voice, to feel comfortable in that voice?
In writing, probably so, because I was an academic, and growing up in Middle Georgia isn't necessarily an asset to an academic writer. On the other hand, if you're writing, you know, swampy adventure fiction, it is an asset.
Yeah.
And so it was just a matter of giving myself permission or settling back into that voice, and trusting that it was an adequate voice, an adequate way of talking about the world.
So you've mentioned a couple of times characters like the Fiji folk being kind of like the people that you knew in Georgia. My kids pointed out last night, actually, while reading, one of them did unprompted that they seem like Native Americans from Western mm-hmm. stories in some ways.
Yeah.
Is that something you were going after?
Yes.
Is that okay? So they're on to something there.
They are on to something.
Yeah. I actually had not thought of it quite that way. I was thinking of them a little bit more. I don't know. Like in my head, there's something more like some character from an Elmore Leonard novel or something.
Yeah.
But that's an adult's perspective. You know, for them, they'll watch a Western movie or read a Little House on the Prairie book or something. And so they're catching on to something there. So
the Fiji folk are kind of, they sit at that part of the Venn diagram where every kind of wildness, every kind of wildness that we love, the idea is they do all of it, right? So whether that's the, as you said, the swamp people in an Elmore Leonard, you know, he has one set in Florida. He has at least one set in Florida, doesn't he?
Oh yeah.
A lot of
them,
right?
Yeah, I think so. Miami and different.
Yeah. So those kind of swamp people, and you said Native Americans specifically, the language, even the word Fiji is inspired by, you know, all those Creek Indian place names where I grew up. They have the Ichi.
Okay.
I grew up going to the Ichikani Creek and the Ogeechee, and the all that Ichi sound is a very there's a Kinchafuni river down there, so that's kind of where that came from. Also, Fiji is a Scottish slang, old Scottish word that means something like slippery and nasty. So Native Americans, kind of good old boys, swampers, just all that kind of stuff rolled up. And because I was always interested in the idea that wild streak that everybody has isn't something just to be tamed out of us. It's something that God put there for a reason. And there's more to it than just something that has to be tamed out of us.
Was that your favorite part of writing, creating those characters and getting the voice?
Yeah.
It seems like it in reading them that you had fun writing those.
Yeah.
How much of Dobra, for example, or how do you pronounce it?
Dobra.
Okay. So how much of that is inspired by your own kids. I was wondering that the other day. Like, it seems like some of the wrestling that these kids do and the sort of wildness has to have been, in some ways at least, inspired by your own kids.
Yeah, my own kids, and just the there's a tradition that still survives, of country people admiring physical courage or valuing physical courage in a way that maybe we lose in our suburban life, at my school there was literally a fist fight every day. That was just something that was part of the entertainment, I can't, although one suspects there's still some schools around where there's that much of that foolishness going on, but definitely my own kids were, always going, we have a creek nearby where they were always catching animals. And so there was plenty of that. But also just that kind of American tradition, and I say American, maybe it's, who knows, all over the world, but in my own experience, there's this, as I said, the physical courage, that's such an important part of, the way some people interact with each other. So all the wrestling, all the fighting, all the hands-on connection with animals. I used to work with a guy who would go out and hunt wild boar every night after work, through the night without a gun. He would just tie them up. He had a dog that would catch him by the ear, and he'd tie him up and carry him out on a pole. And that was actually he was the original for Dobro, a guy named Jake. and he came to work crying one day because an alligator had eaten his dog. Mm. And so I thought, if you think about Aiden, he's living this very civilized life, and just, a few yards away, here's Dobro Turtlebane being Dobro Turtlebane. That's kind of what I felt with this guy, Jake, that I was kind of living this. I was actually a PhD candidate at the time, but I was working by day with this guy who was living this wild existence at night. And it kind of got me thinking about this idea of wildness being right there in the corner of our eye,
Do you see yourself in particular in any of the characters?
Well, I mean, I think any character, there's gotta be some part of the author in it probably. But I guess in some ways I relate to Aiden more than anybody. And that's those stories, just as a person who wants to be courageous, but is not especially good at it, or just learning how.
Yeah.
I'd like to be more like Dobro, but truth is I'm not all that much like Dobro. I like to pretend. Hmm.
Did you have like goals for what you wanted kids to get out of these stories, like some kind of a lesson, or was it for you just crafting a good story that was going to have the right sort of energy and tone and mood? And
I was just trusting that if I told a good story, any kind of themes or messages would take care of themselves. I'm always interested in stories that convey grace, stories that it's kind of hard to. I mean, I don't know if it's fair to say it's hard to find kid stories. Let me just say it's easier. It's easier to write a kid story that's about, the conflict between good and evil, or doing the right thing, it's easy to shape a legalistic story for children.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But how do you shape a story that's about grace? That's always been an interesting idea to me, and my ears perk up when I find a story that's really about grace, or that finds a way to communicate the idea of grace to children. I think there's an element of grace in a lot of stories, but children's stories, it's hard to communicate the idea of grace to children, and so that's always an interest of mine. I was trying not to think in terms of theme or lesson or moral or anything like that.
Yeah.
I do believe that a well-crafted story, you don't have to worry about the whatever message there is in the story. As Flannery O'Connor said, it's not like the theme is something you can climb out of the story and find. You know, you have to go through the story to get it.
Yeah, yeah. So, if I'm not mistaken, well, you've mentioned it, you kind of implied it a couple of times that, you know, the American Western stories have been an influence. And you mentioned, you know, even Lonesome yeah. Dove as a book that you love. Do you feel like these books, despite maybe not taking place in like Texas or Arkansas or like the Rocky Mountains or something, do they mm-hmm. sort of fall into that tradition of Western, American Western literature, that's kind of where you see them fitting the most precisely?
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned the so-called Southwest humor stories. Right. Those are all set in what now we call the Southeast, but they're at a time when the American frontier was, you know, east of the Mississippi River. And so, they're definitely, my books definitely, I hope, fit in that Western tradition, because they're about a frontier. You know, the Cornwall is a frontier country. They were settling it from west to east because the big continent was to the east, and they were kind of moving in the other direction. But yeah, there's definitely, it's a frontier story. Whether you can call that a Western or, you know, probably more properly, it's a frontier story rather than a Western.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Have you read A.B. Guthrie's books by any chance?
No.
You should. I think you'd like those. The Way West, The Big Sky. I think one of them, I think maybe Big Sky won the Pulitzer actually back in the 40s or 50s.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember hearing about that.
You should check those out. Martin Cawthron from Memoria Press put me onto those a couple of years ago. Uh-huh. Okay, so I won't keep it too much longer. I had Sarah McKenzie on the show recently, and I asked her what she thought of the current state of children's and young adult novels. And she said there's plenty of good ones, you know, that it's a myth that there's not as much good young adult and children's fiction. And one of the books that she mentioned in particular as a defense of that stance is your series. So I'm curious if you can point to any, I mean, you mentioned a few of the Rabbit Room ones, but if there's any other books that are children's or young adult books that are contemporary that are, you know, have come out in the last couple of years that you really like. And I've got a couple of rapid fire questions for you here as we wrap up.
Okay. Well, I mean, I love anything that, that Kate DiCamillo writes. I think she's brilliant. She's really one of my favorites. And the Rabbit Room, I love all those Rabbit Room titles. The Wing Feather Saga, Danger New Pop and the Dog, and Jennifer Trafton's books. Am I forgetting somebody? Pete Peterson has two great books for people who are a little older. I wouldn't give them to a elementary school kid because they're pirate books, and the pirates actually act like pirates. You know, they talk like pirates and behave like pirates. The Fiddler's Gun and Fiddler's
Grip. I would hope.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's not like Smee and Captain Hook, you know. Yeah. But the truth is, I'm not very up on young people's literature, to tell you the truth. I need to be.
Okay, so like I said, some more rapid fire questions as we close here for you. What advice would you have for maybe some young people who are, or maybe not so young, but people who have read your books and but like you, are kind of aspiring writers that would love to tell stories like what you're telling. What advice would you have for them? And I'm sure you could talk for a long time about this, but in a couple of bullet points or something, what would you say?
I think I would just say to really pay attention to the world around you. I mean, that originality is probably the most overrated of the writerly virtues, that anybody who really gets good at portraying what is right in front of them is going to almost by definition be original. The originality takes care of itself if you just get good at depicting what you actually see in front of you, because, you know, the combination of things you've seen is different from the combinations of things that everybody else has seen, and, you know, you literally have your own perspective on the things that you've seen. So I think that's really just such an important idea, to really get good at depicting what's in front of you. You know, the Wilder King, there's nothing original in the Wilder King stories. There's no landscape that is made up. There's no, I don't think there's any plot line that I didn't rip off from somebody else. you know, sometimes there are scenes in those books where literally I went to a restaurant in South Georgia and just got people to tell me stories. And the next day, one or two of those stories would be in the book. Hmm. And so, which is another way of paying attention to what's going on around you. That's listening to the stories people are telling.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really think, well, I've already said this, originality is, when you're striving for originality, it rarely works. Hmm. But when you're just trying to tell the truth, originality takes care of itself.
What would be on your deserted island book list? Say you can take two or three books with you and you're stranded for a long time and you can only take two or three books. What are you taking? Let's say the Bible is not included.
Okay. I was about to Jesus juke you and say, I'm just going to take one book and that's the Bible.
let's just say there's like seven Bibles buried on the island. Okay. Part of the fun is you have to find them. But in the meantime, sometimes you want to stop and read because you're tired.
Okay. Let's see. How many books?
Two or three.
All right. I'm not going to be able to say what my two or three favorite is. I'm just going to throw out a couple that mean a lot to me.
Okay.
Bartram's Travels, I'm crazy about.
Okay. I like that. That's the one that I've never heard anyone say when I asked that question before.
Yeah. I mean, and that's not really, it's not that, I'm just mentioning it because people don't read it enough. One thing I love about Bartram's Travels is when that guy made his trip through the American South, those rivers to him were as exotic as the Congo. You know, they were as wild and as, you know, he didn't know if there was going to be tigers jumping out. He didn't know what was going to be happening. And those are the same rivers that I grew up, you know, paddling around on or going up and down on a John boat. And just the idea of somebody experiencing those as if they were, as I said, the Congo, that wild. I just love that idea. So I just love reading those books and sort of thinking about what did South Carolina look like? What did the Carolinas look like in that era?
And how do you spell that for people who?
Bartram's Travels.
Yep.
Bartram is Bartram.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure on that one. You got a second one?
Let's see. If I hadn't already said Lonesome Dove, I would say Lonesome Dove, but I'm going to.
Lonesome Dove's nice and long too. So it gives you
that's true. Yeah. I'm looking for long books.
Paradise Lost.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I got to have the collected works of Flannery O'Connor.
Okay.
The short stories. Okay.
Hey, what's your favorite O'Connor story, would you say?
That depends on what day you ask me. probably more often than any other story, I answer Good Country People.
Okay.
That's a great story. They're all great.
Yeah.
The one I recommend people to start with is Revelation.
Okay.
I always say, if you don't like Revelation, you're probably not going to like Flannery O'Connor.
that's probably true.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then Shakespeare. We're going to say Shakespeare.
Okay. All right. What books are on your nightstand right now? What are you reading like today? What are you going to read tonight?
Well, thanks to Close Reads, I am reading another Charles Portis book I've never read, called Masters of Atlantis.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Have you read that?
I'm partially in it right now. I haven't finished it yet. So I'm reading that at the same time as reading True Grit. It's confusing me a little bit, but
Let's see what else is on my nightstand. I've got a huge stack that's about to fall over on me, but that doesn't mean I'm reading them.
right.
I'm in the middle of the Aeneid for at New College Franklin. I'm teaching through the Aeneid. About to start The City of God. And then John Donne's poetry is the other thing I'm teaching in the next week. So, most of my reading these days is for New College.
Yeah. Are you a movie guy? You like movies?
I do like movies. I got the movie pass, so I'm watching a lot more movies than I used to.
So, your desert island.
Yeah.
Has the ability to watch movies. What are the two or three that you would say are some of your favorites? Maybe in particular ones that influence or inspire you as a storyteller.
The movie that's influenced me more than any other as a storyteller is Raising Arizona.
Okay. Yeah. Nice. Good. I like that. You know what? Now that you mentioned that, I can see that.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the first time I ever saw a movie and thought about the fact that somebody wrote it. which I guess in some ways is maybe not a good thing because the writing wasn't invisible. But
maybe not to you. But the writing captured you in some way, and you thought, yeah, like I'd like to do what that person did.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and so I love that movie. I just saw it last week again for the first time in a long time. I love this is not all time. There's something I've seen recently that I liked. Hunt for the Wilder People. Have you seen that?
No.
Oh my goodness.
Hunt for the Wilder People.
Hunt for the Wilder People. It's a Taika Waititi movie.
Yeah.
New Zealand.
Yeah.
It is such a sweet movie and hilarious.
Okay.
And I love that movie. I just saw Thor Ragnarok recently, another Taika Waititi movie. I thought that was fantastic.
I haven't seen that one either. I'm way behind on my superhero movies.
Yeah. I don't care anything about superhero movies, but when I saw that Taika Waititi had done it, I thought, I want to see that. And it was really funny. Hmm. And then at the end, it just turns into a regular superhero movie. that just bores me. The superhero thing just bores me.
But at least you had some fun until it happened.
That's right. Yeah. I love Black Panther. Have you seen that?
I did. I saw Black Panther. Yeah.
I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. It tries to do things that other superhero movies aren't doing.
That's right.
You know, even beyond having a cast that is primarily African American, you know, it goes beyond that, which is obviously an awesome thing and revelatory to see these actors. But some of the storytelling conventions that it kind of turns on its head and turns on their head, I guess. And the fun that it's having, I think it's there's a certain kind of fun that superhero movies have that feels like it's trapped in a box sometimes.
Yes.
And they think it's going to be fun, so they feel like they have to do it. Whereas Black Panther is having fun in its own way. Like it's saying that this is what we think is fun and we're going to do this. And it turns out to actually be fun because it's not sort of conventional fun, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. No, it does make sense.
All right. So let's wrap this up. I've used enough of your time. Where can people find the Wilder King trilogy, if they would like to get their hands on that? And then you have to tell us I think you mentioned you have a newsletter for people that are about writing. So tell us where people can find out about that as well.
Yeah, I've just since January, I've been writing a weekly newsletter called The Habit, and just kind of takes on some topic related to writing every week. Comes out on Tuesdays. And so at my personal website, jonathan-rogers.com, on, I think it's the left side, maybe the right side, there's a thing that says sign up for The Habit. And that's a good, I've really enjoyed connecting with people through that. And then one thing I do in The Habit is announce when I have online writing classes that I'm starting. So about every 6 weeks or so, I do an online writing class for grownups. And that's a really fun thing that I do.
Nice. That sounds great.
Besides my, daily teaching at New College, which your listeners need to know about New College too, if they don't. New College Franklin.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident many, if not all, of our listeners know about New College. So, but we love partnering with y'all. And
well, we sure love what y'all are doing at Searcy, in the ways you are educating people about the classical education, because you and I have not been talking about classical education today, but I'm pretty fired up about that too.
Well, I think we're not specifically talking about it, but we're not too far afield.
Yeah.
So, where can people find your books? Is that Rabbit Room Amazon, or where would you?
Rabbitroom.com is a great place to find them because that supports the Rabbit Room, which is a great organization that people also need to know about if they don't.
Is that rabbitroom.com you said?
Rabbitroom.com.
All right.
And Amazon is doing okay without you. but the Rabbit Room would benefit. But you can also get free shipping at Amazon. So I get it. But so really any place you buy books online, you can get my books. But I do like to direct people to the Rabbit Room when I can.
Yeah, fair enough. Understandable. We get the same thing. We get it. All right. Well, Jonathan Rogers, thank you for joining me here on the show. And
thank you, David.
I'm loving reading the books with the kids. It's been a great experience. The boys are loving them. And, I hear them talking about them when we're not reading them. So that's always a good time. So I wanted to get you on pick your brain a little bit, hear a little bit about how these stories, you know, came to be. And we will be looking for the fifth book in 2011.
Yeah, right. 2011. Give me your time machine. All right. Thanks, David.
Yeah, thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.